It's mainly a series of questionnaires that we issue and deals with some of their private lives and this sort of thing. Should this information be divulged in the raw sense, again, you would jeopardize that kind of a program and the privacy of those people. And we would not only be able to do that one time, I'm sure. We also have a considerable amount of collaborative research with industry. At Oregon State University, at this time, it amounts to about $5 million a year. In order to work with industry, and of course we all realize that industry is here to make a profit and to get an edge on the market, there is frequently an exchange of proprietary information, particularly from the company into the institution as it begins to carry out its research. We are by contract bound not to divulge that information. However, our faculty are still bound to publish. If, however, that data were giving up ahead of time, before publication, in release to a Public Information Act or something of that nature, you would imagine that industry would no longer collaborate with any of our institutions. What we do in a sense of holding on to data is that we will deter the publication of a paper, perhaps 3, maximum 6 months, in order to seek a patent where one is appropriate. And that's the extent of withholding information from the public. Years ago, I was concerned with my own program when I came. I'm an oceanographer. I came on the beach, and I had been warned ahead of time that a private citizen wanted copies of all my records within hours that they had been taken. I probably would have scuttled them over the side, and that would have meant at least $500,000 thrown away. That sort of thing scares us from time to time. Right now, the greatest scare that we have is when people call and want to request copies of proposals that our faculty members have made, particularly in dealing with the protocols of using laboratory animals. Thus far, we have not released that types of information. Proposals are those things that are made ahead of being funded. Once things are funded, they become public record, and then they are allowed to be public. But even the National Science Foundation will not release proposals because those are concepts put forth by the people themselves. And so we propose here this amendment to the current bill. My feeling is that the current bill, which talks about research notes, are ill-defined. And we propose the wording that you have before you, where we use the word writings, which is a well-defined term already in ORS, to as a point of reference. And that would help secure the assurances that we need to continue the work that we have going in research. For the record, I'd like to insert a journal item, article from 1983-84 from the Journal of College and University Law that discusses this issue in some depth and resulted in discusses a law that was put forth in the state of Virginia to deal just with the issues that I'm talking about here. Thank you.
Any questions? All right. Thank you for being here. We have no further witnesses on Senate Bill 219, so we'll call. Oh, counsel?
Yes, I'd like to call the members' attention to a letter from the head of the Information Services Division for the City of Eugene, speaking to the proposed provision about computer programs and setting forth why they think that's a useful provision.
I tell you, one thing I would like to see in some session someday is somebody who's willing to take ORS 192.500 and break it down in pieces so that every time you change a punctuation mark, you don't have to have 3 pages of bill to do it. Ungodly long and unwieldy section of the code. Senator Hamby?
I'd like to ask counsel if the proposed amendment proposed by higher ed might not also include a syllabus or coursework in connection with study. It could well, could have not. I mean, it's so terribly broad. But
I would have to think about that, but I think you can make an argument about that, yes.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. All right, let's, I want to go to a work session on Senate Bill 20. Oh, wait a minute, now, hold it, stop, back up. We've got to change drivers here if I do that. What do we have, two more? We got two more. Okay, I think we'll take up Senate Bills 20 and 21 last because I have to change counsel here and we have to stop the proceedings and I don't want to do that. So let's go to, let's go to Senate Bill 497. And after 497, we will go to 502, and then we'll go to 493. So, Senate Bill 497, and we don't have any witnesses signed up on that.
Mr. Chair, I can...
We do now. Okay. Come on up, Mr. Putnam. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Putman. I'm manager of recovery services for the Adult Family Service Division. Both of these bills are a product of a governor's commission on child support enforcement, which was active summer of last year, held public hearings throughout the state on the various problems associated with child support. One of the testimonies frequently given to that advisory commission was that the non-custodial parent in trying to change visitation rights frequently did not know where the custodial parent was and could not find out where she was, normally a woman, because the records of the agency are confidential. The commission drafted a rather simple bill which would allow such a parent in those circumstances to serve the agency. We in turn would send that service by certified mail with return receipt requested to our last known address, and that would constitute service. The bill before the committee goes beyond that, and I think does a couple of things which were not the intent of the commission, and I have not been able to determine why the drafting of the bill differs from that which the commission sent forward. However, the two points of difference are: first, the bill would limit our help to those cases that are actively receiving public assistance. However, the very circumstances that might want to cause a visitation order to be changed might be the reasons that cause the case to close. So I'm just saying if we have the address, we would be glad to make a mailing to that last known address. Secondly, the bill also now requires that we provide service. The commission's intent was that we attempt service by mail. And there's a whopping difference between our trying through mail and shall provide service. So I would tell you that our agency supports the concept behind the legislation and ask that you consider substituting the wording put forth by the commission in lieu of the draft that was sent, that was actually filed. I had discussed that issue with Senator Cohn, who was a member of the commission. It was her advice to me that we allow the bill to be introduced as is and deal with the amendment before the committee.
I would agree. I agree with Mr. Putnam, Mr. Chairman. I think we ought to. I think the bill is a significant of enough of an issue that we ought to amend the bill and try to work on it and get it. Because it is really difficult for people to attempt to locate people. Not that they want to necessarily see them, but they need to make some kind of contact in the whole process. And I think it's useful if the agency's willing to do it, as he outlines, that we try to accommodate, make that accommodation.
All right. Any questions?
Is this adoptees?
what
it's primarily, contact what people? It's just in support enforcement area. No, it doesn't deal with adoptees. It's the support enforcement issue. And if they want to change visitation, they want to do a summons to bring them in to change the visitation or anything, sometimes the non-custodial parent has no way to locate, to even have served a summons to get them into court because of the inability to find them. So it's not, you're asking them to pass on information to summons.
All right. Any other questions? Now let's see now.
Yeah, we have, Mr. Kai, I have a
yes, question. Senator Cohen, go ahead.
Would you're then, the third page of your testimony is really your proposal for amending it that the agency, that you'd support and you think is reasonable?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, yes. That's the exact wording right out of the commission report.
Right.
No changes.
Yeah, I have no understanding why it got so mixed up in the legislative council because that was really what they...
Okay. All right, stay right there. Then I don't think there are any other witnesses on 497. So we'll go to Senate Bill 502.
Mr. Chairman, again for the record, I'm Keith Putman, Manager of Recovery Services for the Adult and Family Service Division. This, too, is a bill recommended by the Governor's Commission on Child Support. The concept of this bill is that there should be an advisory council to assist in the establishment of proper amounts for ordering of child support. And as you well know, this is an issue where dispassionate debate isn't commonplace, and trying to set up these kind of standards would be helped by a committee of this standing. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer one suggestion, which admittedly is not a major issue with us, but the bill asks that the committee meet at the call of the director of the Department of Human Resources. We would simply request that good management have you change that to the administrator of the Adult Family Service Division. Just saves writing a few letters. I don't think it changes the concept or the result or outcome or anything else.
Any questions, Mr. Putnam? All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brad Swain.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. The Judicial Department has taken no position on the concept or policy of the bill, but in our review of the bill, we noticed a practical concern that the committee may want to address if it decides to deal with this bill favorably. What we noticed is that while the bill establishes a committee to deal with creating standard support standards statewide, it doesn't provide for any staff for the committee or to say where the committee is to operate out of. As this committee knows, staff for a committee does all of those things like research, sets up meeting rooms, provides for the meetings, gets correspondence out, those sorts of things. And the bill is silent on who is to staff this. We felt, just for the committee's concern, it might be appropriate that the Department of Human Resources do the staffing on this bill, because the Department of Human Resource is the one that calls these meetings and is basically responsible for it. We'd also like to note that in subsection 4 of section 1 of the bill, there's a requirement to disseminate information, and we thought we would mention, and that requirement is given to the State Court Administrator's Office. There are currently people in the Department of Human Resources who are not only involved in developing information on child care or child support standards, but in disseminating that kind of information. We thought it might be appropriate if the Department of Human Resources handled that responsibility, since they're already doing something similar, and it might create an expansion of their existing program, but it would be different than the State Court Administrator's Office, which has no experienced staff in the area and would have to establish a whole new program to do that.
Senator Cohen?
I think, Brad, the problem that was noted in the testimony, and again, this is one of the unfortunate situations. I hope we all learn by this. When we create commissions and then we cause them to come to the end of their lifetime in the middle of anything, and their all of their work and all the time spent with gathering public testimony comes down to the next legislative session with no one to either explain it or follow through on it. But that's an editorial comment for all of us to learn. The problem, as it was, people expressed concern, was that not only were the standards unclear or that they need to be more objective and needed to be developed, but that the judges didn't pay attention to them. And my guess is that's why you have the state court administrator, because they wanted that information to be disseminated more specifically to the people who were in fact utilizing in some degree, in some cases, those kinds of things. So I'm not objecting to the Department of Human Resources. It's just by way of description that part of the problem comes not just in the general public understanding of what the guidelines are or might be, but the judges and the people who are involved in the system.
There, if I might, Mr. Chair, there are also people in the Department of Human Resources who establish support payments through their administrative process. And anyway, we thought we would raise these concerns because they were issues that the committee might want to consider when it looks at the bill.
Any further questions? Senator Wires.
On subsection 4, the last sentence, the reasons for departing from the standards must be given in a written statement accompanying any order for support in an amount substantially different from that of the objective standard. That is talking about an order that's made by a court as well as by an ministry. That's going to... Since judges don't prepare orders, lawyers do, that's going to be something where we're going to have to teach all the judges and then all the lawyers that they're going to have to be aware of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wires, we understand that there are some judges who do prepare their own orders in certain circumstances, and frankly the department has gotten mixed reviews from judges on the substance of the bill and how that would affect them. Some judges think the bill is great, others think that would create a problem for them, and the department hasn't taken a position on that.
Well, this bill would not only affect support enforcement cases, it would also affect decrees that contain support amounts.
Yes.
Doesn't it? I got a little problem with that particular provision. I might not have a problem with it if we had a little amendment there that said in cases where the district attorney is involved or something like that, where you've got a support enforcement activity going on. But if you've just got a standard divorce, that's going to be, I suppose, another grounds for malpractice. If somebody misses doing that and somebody comes back later and says their subsequent lawyer knows this statute and the previous lawyers didn't, say, well, gee, you didn't get as much child support as you should have, and not only that, the judge didn't require the lawyer to include that in the order, and the one of the lawyers should have picked that up. And on the white rats theory around here, you know, the lawyers do tend to be very critical of each other's work, and particularly when they get a new client and they can second guess what the prior lawyer didn't do. And if we're trying to avoid creating more litigation, I think we ought to, if that's one of the goals of the session, then we ought to consider some other way to get this to be paid attention to other than mandating that it has to be included in every order, where there's a substantial deviation from the standards, I think.
No, I think there are some difficulties with implementation. Well, But it is a discussion area, which is probably more than what we want to deal with, at least today, or without any great work.
This is a laudable purpose overall, but maybe needs some fine-tuning or something.
I just think it's a problem that is of a major concern in the whole area of every session, at least not on this side this time, but we have the whole problems of rewriting the domestic relations code, and one of the things that causes a lot of trauma and a lot of difficulty in that whole setting of support originally. Fairness, the whole fairness issue is right, sort of boiled down right there.
Yeah, and it's good to have standards, I agree.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you. That will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 502. We'll go to Senate Bill 493. Senator Cohn, I've got Kathleen Haley and Elmer Kramer signed up. Who would you suggest testify first?
I'd rather have me do it first.
Okay.
Since I'm not sure what they're going to say, and I need to tell that they're not. I'll tell you why now.
Okay.
They would probably be surprised for them. Mr. Chairman, colleagues, this Senate bill, I'm Joyce Cohen for the record, Clackamas County, on Senate Bill 493. Senate Bill 493 came to my attention because of my interest along the way in following the Psychiatric Security Review Board, its operations, and my involvement in it since I served on the House side in reviewing its activities there on that Judiciary Committee. There in 1986, there was a court ruling that came about that I think warrants discussion by the legislature this time on what if anything we ought to make in terms of changes which might impact on how they do their job and how they work with their charges or clients, or however you want to call them. Senate Bill 493 would make health care providers under contract with the Psychiatric Security Review Board agents of the state and thereby allow them to be covered by the Oregon Tort Claims Act. You'll see in the testimony it came about a Riken, let's see what it is, the case citing here, Kane v. Riken. It was a decision December 1985. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled that a community health care provider having accepted mental health patient under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Review Board had a duty to supervise the patient's conduct for the protection of the general public. For this reason, Providence Medical Center was held liable for the death of James Kane. The court case was that Paul Riken, who was conditionally released and enrolled in the psychiatric daycare treatment program, was apparently a schizophrenic and was in a uncontrollable phase at that point. It went out and accidentally ran a red light, killed someone by the name of James Kane. The Oregon Tort Claims Act permits suits against every public body for its torts. Employees and agents acting within the scope of their employment or duties. In their contract with the State Mental Health Division, Providence is specified as an independent contractor and not an agent of the state. Providence argued, however, that they were acting on behalf of the Mental Health Division and were therefore, in fact, agents. Again, regarding the determination of the agency in this context, the court determined that because this issue was not fully developed at the trial level, they couldn't decide from the record whether there were facts relevant to the issue, and they couldn't decide it as a matter of law. And for this reason, the question of Providence's immunity was decided on the basis of a contract, and Providence was not granted immunity under the Tort Claims Act. Again, it is left to the legislature to clarify the statute and ensure that these health care providers are granted immunity. one of the ways to have done it was to just automatically declare them as having immunity, and I'm certainly not prepared to go that far, because I think there are times when we don't want to automatically give people immunity. With all due respect, though, I do think that the preserving the ability of the Psychiatric Review Board to function and to make sure that the people they contract within the community are willing to take their cases, it is worth our consideration to determine whether we want to extend that liability to include their contractors as agents of the state. There is an amendment technically providing that the state acting for the Mental Health Division as a contractor or subcontractor be added if we should move ahead with this bill. This deals primarily with who is, from an administrative standpoint, the agency that signs the contracts, and that is, in fact, the Mental Health Division. I bring this to you for your consideration as we move along and as we continue to be concerned that the Psychiatric Security Review Board specifically be continuing its activities to keep people in the community as best they can and to have full compliance with every kind of mental health provider that they can put within their grasp or willingness to participate. We do have a fiscal impact statement on this bill after going through some of the risk management, and it is $6,700, apparently, as best they can gather, to cover the clients of the Psychiatric Review Board who are out in the community in the mental health. And the agencies are here. I'm not sure what they're going to say, but it is here for your consideration. Thank you.
Questions, Senator Cohen?
Yeah. That $6,700, who gave it? Gave you that fiscal impact?
It's my understanding that someone in my office called the risk management group in General Services.
So what we'd be saying is we'd be hitting the ground somewhere between exempting these people from liability and the current law, which is that the providers are have to buy their own insurance as part of their contract, then they'd be repaid that through their contract with the state. That's what the current situation is, isn't it?
Yes, the current situation is that yes, in fact, they are. There was $1 million award in this case.
Be paid for by state. I guess I could ask the director of this. I guess I don't have a question. I guess I have a comment.
We're just
going to say that instead of a person being able to recover whatever cap we pass this session for non-economic damages, there'd be $100,000 the family of somebody who got killed by somebody who was under PSRB and out in a community program would be $100,000.
I think it's
economic or non-economic.
I think, you know, it is essentially that kind of a trade-off, and I'm here bringing this case to you, and I would command that you look, and I'll get copies of it if you're interested in all, and moving in looking further at this bill of the court case itself and see what you think about it. Again, it was brought to my attention by a constituent, and I think it's fair to bring it here because of the Psychiatric Review Board and its functions, and we do have some obligation to look at what that means to them as an agency.
Well, I'm a real supporter of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, but I don't know if I want to go back and tell my constituents that people who are on parole to them in a contractual program, families of the deceased would be limited to $100,000 recovery.
I'd have you look at the case. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? All right, thank you. Let's see. Elmer Kramer, please.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Elmer Kramer. I'm manager of community programs for programs for mental and emotional disturbances for the Mental Health Division. The Mental Health Division supports the concept underlying the Senate underlying Senate Bill 493, and I think the reason that we use the word concept is because the providers of services to conditionally released psychiatric security review board clients in some ways are the same as providers who provide foster care services and group home services, for example, in the community. In other words, the division, as you know, contracts with community mental health programs, and the local community mental health program or county program can contract or subcontract with other providers. And by supporting the concept, we're really saying that we're very sensitive to the issue that we have difficulty recruiting providers not only for psychiatric security review board services, but also for foster care.